Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, a look at the Biden administration's approach toward Afghanistan as the May 1 deadline for the pullout of U.S. troops looms. But first, joining us now is Randy Shriver, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Indo-Pacific Security Affairs in the Trump administration, who's now with the Pacific Solutions Consultancy and chairman of the Project 2049 Institute to formally normalize relations between the United States and Taiwan. Randy, it's always an honor and pleasure having you on.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Randy, it's obviously been a big couple of weeks, in Asia and with relations between China and the United States. Next week, there are going to be Quad meetings. Secretary Austin and Secretary Blinken are going to be in the region, and things are going to cap off with a major and important meeting with National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and Secretary Blinken when they meet with Yang Jiechi and Wang Yi in Alaska. Meanwhile, there have been very big party meetings that have been going on in Beijing. Patrick Cronin of the Hudson Institute gave us a little bit of an update last week. Talk to us about the Beijing meetings and what you think are the key takeaways given that crushing of Hong Kong, but also taking of Taiwan loomed large on Beijing's agenda.
In some ways, the Lianhui, the two sessions are symbolic gatherings. The decisions have really been made by the party the previous fall. But in other ways, it's an important benchmark where they go public with a work report and they make more widely known the decisions that were previously made. And in that regard, I think the announcements on Hong Kong and the changes to the electoral laws there, which really, really will prohibit anybody who's for strengthening Taiwan, Hong Kong's democracy and trying to fulfill the promises made in the basic law. All of that is basically squashed. I think the other, if there was news, it probably relates to the five-year economic plan and this idea of technological self-sufficiency. The Chinese are still grappling with tariffs that remain in place, threats to further restrict technology and other inputs for their economy. And so they're trying to figure out, if not completely self-sufficient, how they can remove some of those vulnerabilities. And a lot of discussion about pumping up domestic growth, a lot of discussion about how they can onshore some of the technology that they now rely on other parties for, including the United States. So it was an interesting work report, and I think it's also setting them up for their centennial celebration. A lot of this is all about Xi Jinping, right? And she probably didn't need to further solidify power, but in many ways, he's sort of constantly on the stage justifying his decision to end term limits, if there were ever any real meaningful term limits. He certainly said he'll stay beyond the traditional two-year terms of 5 years each. Excuse me. So he's got to justify that, and I think this is all going to culminate this summer in the centennial celebration of the party.
You know, one of the other important things is right. I mean, Xi has gotten this sort of mega status in part because he promised the Council of Elders to do the three things that they saw as priorities, right? Stick it to the United States, crack down on Hong Kong, and take Taiwan. And that's the source of a lot of the tension in Washington. Recently, we heard from the Indo-Pacific commander, Admiral Davidson, that he thinks that if we're not doing the right things within the next decade, it increases the chance of miscalculation on the part of the Chinese over Taiwan. What is some of the messaging that your expert ear picked up from Chinese leaders on this topic? Because the provocations around Taiwan have steadily been increasing over the past couple of years.
The leadership in Beijing and Xi Jinping have certainly been talking about the unification of Taiwan as being key to its ability to realize its great national rejuvenation. Although not putting specific timelines on it, they've certainly talked about by the midpoint of the century, the 100th anniversary of the founding of the country, as being an important date. When they talk about the military balance and them being able to have high degree of confidence they could succeed in a Taiwan contingency, many are pushing that date forward much further. And you rightfully noted Admiral Davidson's comment that perhaps within 6 years. So I think this is all a campaign of coercion and pressure. Remember, Beijing's ultimate goal is to win without fighting. And so they want to portray growing confidence. They want to portray that they've driven further into the cul-de-sac and that this is really a regime survival issue as another means of trying to create the impression that there's an asymmetry of interest here, and it's just not worth it to us to try to stand in Beijing's way. But all of that aside, there are real capabilities that are coming online that have to be answered if Taiwan is going to continue to survive in its present form. And I think Taiwan is doing the right things. I think the United States and Admiral Davidson's proposal with respect to the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, we're doing the right things. But as the comedian Will Rogers said, even if you're on the right track, you can get run over if you're not going fast enough. We do need a sense of urgency and a sense of purpose here.
What are the capabilities that most worry you, Randy?
Well, certainly they have the ability to damage, destroy, punish through ballistic and cruise missiles. And those numbers have continued to grow, and the lethality and accuracy have continued to get better. So the real question is, beyond being able to destroy things on Taiwan, are they putting together the system of system, the architecture, meaning ISR and logistics support and everything that would be needed to get enough people across the strait to take and hold territory and exert sovereignty over an otherwise unwilling population? So I'm looking at things like strategic lift, amphibious ships, looking at strategic airlift, and the means of suppressing Taiwan's defenses beyond the missiles, which are already in place and capable. So other things they could do to suppress Taiwan's ability to sustain itself in a campaign, the cyber capabilities for disruption and sort of decapitation strategy through cyber means. All of these things come together to create a lot of challenges for Taiwan and its partners, including the United States.
Admiral Davidson certainly laid out the $27 billion multi-year Indo-Pacific Deterrence Initiative. It's really hasn't been very robustly funded over the last couple of years. And I know that there is a measure of frustration the Admiral has had, because there are priority items that end up becoming budgeted for, you know, that he may need immediately. And it becomes sort of a 2024 item somewhere in the budget. You and I have been talking about China as a threat for 20 years and the things that we have to do to prepare for it that we haven't. Do you get a sense that we are at the cusp, and maybe use this as a bridge to talk a little bit about what the new administration is doing, but do you get a sense that we're actually at a tipping point in terms of the seriousness with which we take the challenge and the necessity to actually make the changes that we kind of haven't been making in order to keep deterring the Chinese?
Yes, I think the prioritization in the previous administration, the clarity of giving the Indo-Pacific a place of priority, but really the China challenge is the number one organizing principle for the defense enterprise, was extraordinarily helpful. But resources have lagged. And if you look at what we're actually investing in, we're still lagging. And I think Admiral Davidson's frustration is a reflection of that. Obviously, in our system, these commanders get a window of time, 3 or 4 years, and his may be drawing to a close. But I think he'll be able to say he's handing off to a successor, at least something that's in motion, and the trajectory is the right trajectory, that we're taking the challenge seriously. But, you know, if you look at Kurt Campbell's comments and other people in the Biden administration, they've talked about some potential trade-offs down the line, where maybe some legacy platforms, some conventional platforms, may have to give way to emerging technologies and other means of dealing with the China challenge. That also might be code for defense cuts are coming, and we've got to look at how to prioritize more limited resources. But indications are right now that at least for the next fiscal year, they'll be holding steady, which may in real terms be a decline if you're not keeping pace with inflation. But nonetheless, a number that's you know, certainly defendable given the economic times we're in and the challenges with the pandemic and so on. Not an unreasonable number. But when the resources start to shrink, I've always said that's when you'll really see if China is the priority and the China fight is the priority. When you're growing, you can always add a little more to hypersonics and AI and cyber and space and say you're doing China. But until you actually start to make those trade-offs or are forced to make those trade-offs, it's difficult to say.
Let's spend our last couple of minutes talking about what your expectations are for next week. I mean, obviously, there's the Quad meeting. As we mentioned, Secretaries Austin and Blinken will be in the region, and Sullivan and Blinken are going to meet with Yang Jiechi and Wang Yi in Alaska. It was in 2016 that Yang blasted the Trump administration. This time, I'm told that the Sullivan and Blinken expect to be blasted, and they will blast back. What's your expectation? What do you expect? What are the messages you expect to hear over the coming week from the new administration? And what do you expect to hear from the Chinese in return?
Sure. Just real quickly on the meetings prior to the meeting with the Chinese, I think the Quad at the presidential level is a tremendous development. I applaud the Biden administration for going forward with that, as well as our counterparts in Japan, India, and Australia. It's a strong statement of intent that we're going to make this quadrilateral grouping more meaningful and place more priority on it as a mechanism for pursuing our shared interests in the region. I think that's very positive. The work with the Japanese and the Koreans, I think this is part of what the Biden administration would call reinvesting in alliances and sort of normalizing from the previous administration, where things were a little more uneven. A lot of good work done on the alliance, I would say, but certainly some mixed messages when it came to issues like burden sharing. So I think this is a bit of a reset, but really a kind of a return to normal practice. The meeting with Yang Jiechi and Wang Yi in Alaska, I suspect they'll mostly be taking the measure of one another. When you say giving lectures, I think, yes, there are standard talking points that both sides will want to get out. But really, I think they want to take one another's measure. The Chinese were hoping that the Biden administration would be a reset and a return to normal in terms of U.S.-China engagement. I think thus far what they've seen is more continuity than they might otherwise have expected. And from my perspective, that's a good thing. But they want to take the measure of these guys and vice versa. I think, the Chinese have certainly, through their own behavior, and you've mentioned some of the issues, Hong Kong, certainly at Xinjiang, you've talked about Taiwan, the handling of coronavirus. You know, I think these guys want to know, is there going to be room for cooperation amidst competition? John Kerry won't be present, but certainly there's an interest in cooperating with the Chinese on climate change. There's an interest in finding other areas where we can work with one another, and they're going to be taking the temperature on that.
Let me ask very briefly, you're at Project 2049, a very, very important date, an important date not just for China and the creation of the People's Republic of China, but also of the Republic of China. Very briefly, does the United States need to have a declaratory Taiwan policy at this point?
You know, there's a debate about strategic clarity versus the legacy policy of strategic ambiguity. And I personally am in favor of greater clarity. I think we should be able to say publicly and mean it, that it is in our interest for Taiwan to continue to exist and continue to survive in its current status or better, because Taiwan is a like-minded partner and shares our vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific. It is not in our interest for Taiwan to fall under the control of the CCP in Beijing. We should be able to say those things and mean it. there's always going to be some degree of tactical ambiguity. How might you respond in the event of a crisis? Because a lot of that will be very scenario dependent, dependent on how Beijing might use its military means to pressure or coerce. I mean, there's a difference between a blockade and a strike or invasion. And so all these things, you're always going to want some degree of tactical ambiguity, but I am in favor of more strategic clarity in terms of our support for Taiwan's continued survival and existence.
And I should say, as a fellow democratic state, right, in the region, which is something that's very important. Randy, thanks so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure having you on. Look forward to having you on again, especially after the series, and maybe we can have a panel discussion with you and a couple of other folks on what you thought was interesting at the end of what is going to be a fascinating week. Thanks so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And joining us now is Lisa Curtis, the former senior director for South and Central Asia at the National Security Council for President Trump, who is now the director of the Indo-Pacific program at the Center for a New American Security. Lisa, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
An absolute pleasure. As we enter the 20th year of active U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, until January, you served in the Trump administration, where the plan was to reduce the U.S. troop presence in the country on May 1. The Biden administration is looking at what comes next. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has made it clear that the May 1 deadline remains on the table, and then it's up to the Ghani government to strike a deal with the Taliban. The administration also has released its 8-page peace plan. What's the way ahead here, Lisa? I know that policymakers for decades have been struggling with Afghanistan. Obviously, from Washington's perspective, it's a little bit of an obstreperous ally in Kabul. At the end of the day, we also recognize that their paranoia is misplaced. The Taliban really does want to destroy the government and supplant it. Where are we now? Where do we need to be, given U.S. strategic interests and investment in the region, as well as to keep our allies' equity in this as well, given that they've invested and sacrificed so much to help pursue what was, in effect, our strategy after 9/11?
Well, there really are three options forward. And let me briefly describe those three options and tell you which one I would personally support. The first is to use U.S. leverage with the Taliban to greater effect, frankly, than we have been over the last couple of years. Keep U.S. forces in the country, a small number. You know, right now there's 2,500 there. Over 8,000 NATO troops also are there. But do that until the peace process is further along and shows real signs of progress. We know we haven't seen that progress yet. Violence is still very high by the Taliban. So we really have not seen any progress made on the peace process over the last year. Now, of course, this means more costs and resources for something that at the end of the day may not work, but it also reduces the risks to U.S. forces that remain in the country if we can keep those peace talks going. The second option is to drop the peace process and keep a minimal level of troops in the country, providing financial assistance, air support, ISR capabilities to the Afghan forces in order to continue to help them. But of course, the risk here is that the Taliban resumes attacks against U.S. forces. It would, of course, provide the Afghan government a fighting chance against the Taliban. And it would mean that the U.S. is not completely abandoning our partners that we've been fighting with for the last 20 years. But it also means continued cost to the U.S. taxpayer without, again, a clear end to our engagement. The third, which many people are advocating, is just immediately pull all U.S. troops out, give up on the mission, which basically means risking civil war, a reemergence of a terrorist safe haven, and a tremendous loss of U.S. global credibility with our allies, but also the empowerment of a generation of extremists. I think those are pretty high costs to pay. We saw what happened when we pulled all troops out of Iraq. With the rise of ISIS, we actually had to go back into Iraq with more troops. So that's a pretty high cost. So I think my support would go toward option one, I think it is possible for the Biden administration to both keep a small troop presence in Afghanistan beyond May, but also keep the peace process going. But it does need to be a more balanced peace process, meaning we need to more effectively use our leverage with the Taliban to extract concessions. We can't keep just expecting the Afghan government to make the concessions and expect to have any kind of genuine peace process come out of it. So that would be my ideas for how we can forge a way forward. There are no guarantees. There are risks with any option that we pursue.
But obviously you were part of the administration and giving advice, right? But the fact that you're a senior director on the National Security Council doesn't mean that ultimately any administration accepts that guidance. What are some ways that the United States should be putting pressure on Taliban, right? I mean, we've been looking at military pressure. What is the best kind of pressure to be applying? Because ultimately, you're absolutely right. The ability of the government in Kabul to do anything is constrained by us, ultimately, right? I mean, we have more of the cards than they do.
Well, the two points of pressure are military pressure, right? Direct military pressure, airstrikes, you know, to support the Afghan security forces when they're actually involved in combat with the Taliban. And the other is to provide support to the Afghan government and the Afghan security forces, provide our financial support, our training, equipment. Those are our best tools sort of against the Taliban. But we can also talk about leverage that comes with carrots. And here we know the Taliban want more prisoners released. They want their leaders delisted. Also, I think a certain segment of the Taliban leadership doesn't necessarily want to be international pariahs like they were in the 1990s. So we can use that leverage. And in fact, our leverage will be stronger if we coordinate closely with our European allies who also provide a lot of assistance to Afghanistan. So I think if we carefully use our carrots and sticks together, that we may be able to kind of keep this peace process going. And the longer the peace talks go, the greater the cost to both parties of exiting those peace talks. And I think that's something we have to keep in mind. That goes for both the government and the Taliban.
Do we need a realization that ultimately, whether we want to be out of Afghanistan or not, Afghanistan might not be done with us? And right, I mean, do we need to have a strategic approach that says, whether we like it or not, for many, many more years to come, U.S. forces and U.S. bandwidth will have to be and remain engaged?
I think that's correct. I've spelled out what I think the risks are to pulling out completely: the reemergence of a terrorist safe haven, civil war, loss of U.S. credibility internationally, empowerment of extremists. But I think the right question to ask, but we all know that, yes, there has been money wasted in Afghanistan, a lot of money, a lot of sunk costs. But if you ask the average American whether an investment of around $5 billion a year, say to keep a small force presence in Afghanistan, is worth preventing another 9/11 style of attack, I believe most Americans would accept that cost. So I think, you know, that's the kind of question we should be asking ourselves. Yes, we need to reduce the amount of resources that we're putting into this endeavor, because clearly there's no cut and dried solution. There's no winning in Afghanistan. It's simply a threat that has to be managed. And so let's figure out a way that we can accept the resources that have to go into managing that threat. And let's look realistically at it. I think one problem I have with the 8-page peace agreement that was floated by the administration, which, you know, to its credit, it may be something that can buy us time in terms of keeping our U.S. troops there and giving the party something to think about and discuss. But as a whole, you know, obviously it's something that is not entirely realistic to think that the Taliban are going to implement that agreement right now. I think we need to be realistic that there's no signing this 8-page peace agreement by May 1st. So I think we need to accept the realities on the ground and then look at our options with lower expectations of what we can expect in the long term.
There are obviously very stark differences between the Trump and the Biden administrations, but what is very similar is the tough line that Washington is taking toward Kabul, whether it was coming from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo or whether it's coming from Anthony Blinken. The letter to the Afghans was very blunt. You've basically got to accept a shotgun wedding with the Taliban or else was a lot of the tone, which was fairly consistent between the two administrations. I remember almost 20 years ago talking to an Afghan official, and his concern was that this was going to end a little bit Vietnam style, right? At the end of the day, this will go on for a very long time, and you'll eventually cut us adrift. And that's the message that countries take from a relationship with the United States. But is there any damage in the United States taking a tough line with an ally and a partner?
Of course, there is a cost. We can talk about the moral or the strategic cost. We have been fighting with the Afghans for the last 20 years. They are our counterterrorism partners. We took four major al-Qaeda leaders off the battlefield with the Afghans over the last 18 months. We are fighting and dying together. So the idea that pulling the rug out from our partners of the last 20 years makes any kind of sense, I think it's just very, very short-sighted and misunderstands what is in the U.S. strategic interest. It may be easier to extract concessions out of our partners because, of course, let's face it, the Afghan government does rely on the U.S. So it's easier to extract concessions from the Afghan government. But does it really get us to where we want to be from a strategic sense? And I think the answer is no. Look, I think the letter from Secretary Blinken to President Ghani that was leaked by the Afghan press over the weekend is very disappointing. It blames President Ghani for the failure of the peace process when, in fact, Taliban violence against Afghans has increased over the last year. These are attacks on human rights activists, journalists, civil society members. So the idea that puts the blame on Ghani is just really misdirected. Let's look at the fact that President Ghani released 5,000 Taliban prisoners and got nothing in return.
Right.
So I think that the threatening tone to the letter is completely misdirected, and it's wholly unjustified, not to mention that it breaches normal diplomatic protocol that should be used with a head of state.
I agree. It was a problematic note to send an ally and a partner that is facing an existential threat, right? The Taliban is not kidding around. And that was my concern and complaint with the last administration strategy is we wanted to get out, and everybody understands that. But how you get out is equally important. I want to commend to the audience the March 4 panel discussion that you participated in. Yalda Hadid of BBC was on it as well. Ambassador Cunningham, Joe Dunford, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and of course, Richard Fontaine, who leads the great CNAS organization. So I commend our audience to, you know, if you have an hour and 18 minutes and you want to get some really illuminating stuff, very worthwhile. And check it out. It's on YouTube as well as on your website. Lisa, thanks so very much for joining us. Absolute pleasure. And look forward to having you on again. We'll have so many questions about the Quad and other Indo-Pacific topics. Really looking forward to having you back on again. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.